Welcome to the New Books Network.
It has been 20 years since the United States invaded Iraq in a bid to locate and destroy weapons of mass destruction. The war led to thousands of Iraqi and American casualties and no weapons of mass destruction. The theory of Saddam Hussein's WMD was promoted by Secretary of State Colin Powell and disseminated by a media that failed to successfully determine the quality of the intelligence on which the case for war was made. In the interim, in addition to the enormous Iraqi casualties, many American war veterans have suffered trauma, major injuries, and even suicide in consequence of their involvement in the war. Some even think the war set the stage for Donald Trump. In short, the consequences of the Iraq War have been momentous. Welcome to International Horizons, a podcast of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies that brings scholarly and diplomatic expertise to bear on our understanding of a wide range of international issues. My name is John Torpy, and I'm director of the Ralph Bunche Institute at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. We're fortunate to have with us today Louis Charbonneau, who is UN Director at Human Rights Watch. Prior to joining HRW, he was a journalist for more than two decades, most recently UN Bureau Chief for Reuters. His first posting with Reuters was in Vienna, where he focused on the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and other UN agencies from 2001 to 2005. He covered the UN weapons inspections in Iraq in 2002 and 2003, and the IAEA's attempts to resolve the nuclear crises in North Korea and Iran. Starting in early 2008, he was based at Reuters Bureau inside UN headquarters in New York, where he followed the Security Council, the General Assembly, and other UN bodies. He's a two-time winner of the Elizabeth Neufer Memorial Award for his UN reporting in 2009 and 2011, as well as recipient of the UN Foundation Prize for his coverage of negotiations on an arms trade treaty in 2013. In New York, he expanded his UN coverage to include human rights and other topics. He has a bachelor's degree from the University of Michigan and master's degrees from both Columbia University and the City College of New York, and he's now working on a PhD in political science here at the CUNY Graduate Center. Thanks so much for joining us today, Lou Charbonneau.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. So, the 20th anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War has received, it seems to me, an enormous amount of attention during the past week. And as a journalist who covered some of the central events leading up to the war, I'd be curious to have you tell us, you know, how exactly you've experienced this coverage, this sort of retrospective view of what happened.
Yeah, thanks. And it's good to be here to talk about it. This 20th anniversary seems to have come so quickly. I can barely remember the 10th anniversary, and in some ways, it feels like it was just a few months ago that it happened, but it does also feel distant. As I was preparing to write a guest column for Reuters, looking back at the time in which I was covering the UN weapons inspections, which was probably the most intense single period of reporting in my entire life, I was basically asked drop everything I was doing. I used to focus at that time mostly on financial reporting, but I had begun covering the UN agencies in Vienna, particularly after 9/11, because of the concern that terrorists could hijack a plane and slam it into a nuclear power plant, or that some militant group could get hold of highly radioactive material from a hospital or something and make a dirty bomb. So it was something that we were looking at closely, but when Iraq announced that it would let the UN weapons inspectors back into the country, which was something I've been thinking about, I've been interviewing UN officials, They kept saying they wanted to go back, finish the job, because they had had to leave in 1998. So there was this period between 1998 and 2002 where no UN inspectors were on the ground and nobody knew what was happening. Then it became increasingly clear that the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, was looking in the post-9/11 period at maybe going into Iraq. And in September of 2002, the Iraqis said, okay, you can come back. And that's when my life changed. And I dropped everything. And so for the next 6 months, I didn't turn off my cell phone. I was flying constantly. It didn't matter whether it was business or first class. I had to try and sit next to people like Hans Blix, who was the head of MOVIC, the UN monitoring inspection and verification commission that was charged with looking at chemical, biological, and ballistic missile technology in Iraq. Also, Mohammed El-Baghdadi, then the director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. So as the bird went, I had to go with them, and I would ask them when they were going to deploy, what are you looking at, what do you think you'll find. Plus, I have the junior people, the inspectors who were training. I went to some of the training sessions where Hans Blix would give pep talks to the inspectors. Some of them looked to me like they were backpackers who'd been rounded up at a bus stop or train station. So I was a little skeptical of what the UN would be able to accomplish, but as the saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover. These people were all pretty impressive. I went and looked at the UN's special investigation laboratory outside Vienna in Cybersdorf, Austria, where they showed me how they would do environmental sampling and basically take dry wipes and glorified Q-tips and people who go and basically swab buildings and walls and things like that, took them back to that lab where we would analyze and promises them for traces of radioactive isotopes and other things that would indicate the presence of a revived nuclear weapons program. And with UNMOVIC, they were doing the same thing for biological, chemical, and other weapons things. So, you know, the general view when you talk to these people is that they all thought there was something there. They're all, when I would ask these people, when you deploy, what are you going to find? And they figured, well, yeah, there's got to be something. Saddam Hussein had a nuclear weapons program that had been found and largely dismantled in the early 1990s. In the 1980s, Israel had bombed an Iraqi nuclear site that was, we knew that they were producing, doing research aimed at developing a nuclear weapon. So it was pretty clear that this was a guy who was trying to do these things. He had used chemical weapons against the Kurds. Most famously in Halabja, we don't know to this day how many people were killed in the chemical weapon cocktail that was used. They had these programs. They've been developing these kinds of weapons for a long time. So everyone just assumed that all of this intelligence that had started coming up after 9/11 was probably worried, and if not, all of it, that there was most likely some reason to believe that there was some truth to it. So in late November of 2002, the inspectors deployed. This came after a kind of long had a period in which the UN and the government of Iraq had to agree on terms of reference for the inspectors to come, and you know, what kind of access they would have. They were supposed to have fair access. The Iraqi government presented a declaration of their weapons programs and basically said that there were no weapons of mass destruction programs, that all of it was defunct. So we found that in hand, the UN inspectors deployed at the very end of November. I believe it was November 27th, 2002. And followed them. The inspectors would come in and out. They had a kind of logistics base in Cyprus. So I would go and hang out in Cyprus and wait for them to come back. And they had a list of sites to visit that they'd gotten from the U.S. There were hundreds of sites, and it was very specific. And what I found in talking to people was that there was absolutely nothing. Every single site that they visited turned up nothing. I mean, some of them weren't even what they were supposed to be. I wish I had all of my notes, but I just remember if there had been one thing that they would found, it would stick out in my mind, but they didn't. There was missile issues that were much talked about at the time in early 2003, but these were all kind of, you know, leftovers, and there wasn't anything to indicate a systematic rebuilding of the program. So in that month, after they deployed in late November, and then the end of 2002, going into 2003, that's when, in my discussions with the UN inspectors, there was a shift in tone. At the end of 2002, beginning of 2003, there was a kind of crisis with North Korea, because it announced that it would be withdrawing from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and would be restarting a mothballed nuclear facility in Yongbyon that had been closed down during the Clinton administration, with Burma working on nuclear weapons. And there was this deal called the Agreed Framework had been negotiated in the early 90s. So there was this huge crisis. And while that was going on, I saw Mohammed al-Baghdadi at the UN, and I asked him how the situation was in Iraq and what they were finding. And he said, well, I'm glad you asked me that, because we were not finding anything. And it's, what about the smoking gun that we've been waiting to find? And he said, there's no smoking gun. We haven't found the evidence. I mean, I'm paraphrasing what he said. I don't remember the exact word, but the no smoking gun, that is verbatim what he said. And so I published an interview, and it caused a bit of a ruckus at the time. The Americans were angry. They're like, why is the UN sort of, you know, determining the outcome of a process that is underway? There was George W. Bush's State of the Union address in January of 2003, in which he talked about Iraqis attempting to get large quantities of uranium from Niger, presumably for a nuclear weapons program or a revived nuclear weapons program. After this was in the Bush State of the Union address, the UN tried to get a hold of the documentation to back up this allegation, which was a very serious allegation. And if there was anything that could have been close to a smoking gun, that might have been it. So they just kept asking the rest for the information. They didn't get it. So let me just jump in and say
there was, you know, lots of smoke. Whether there was fire was obviously less clear. And the U.S. government was unhappy about these findings on the part of the UN. And we have to recall, this is all in the context of the post-9/11 you know, context. And there was, you know, a kind of search on for culprits and, you know, how are we going to find somebody who's going to, how are we going to stop this threat to the United States? And so, you know, Iraq became in a certain way an epicenter of that search. And yet, as you say, I mean, the UN found nothing, but the claims were made and the war was initiated, right? And I mean, I'm also remembering that there were massive demonstrations in Europe and in the United States. I was actually living in Canada at the time, but, you know, and there were demonstrations in Canada. But I mean, these are the biggest demonstrations in Europe in the post-war period. So this was a time of considerable tension between the United States and its European allies. So in any case, I mean, the point really that I want to make, I guess, is that there was a certain amount of prevarication in the course of making this case that, you know, Iraq had to be attacked and these weapons of mass destruction found and destroyed. And that, you know, set the United States on a path, A, of warfare, and B, of, you know, prevarication about what it was doing that has had ramifications, arguably, in, you know, in the subsequent 20 years. So I'm sort of curious, you know, how you would view that or how you wrote about that for Reuters.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point and question that you raise. That, you know, the reason I mentioned the Majura uranium claim was because unlike some of the other several, the aluminum tubes were a famous New York Times story where, yeah, the Americans sent a team of people to the UN to explain how they were for nuclear centrifuges to enrich uranium for weapons. And yeah, these, you know, nuclear scientists took one look at the aluminum tubes and said, these aren't any good for, yeah, nuclear uranium enrichment. But, you know, they would be very good for what Iraq said they were going to be used for, which was for rocket launchers. But the Majura uranium claim was based on forged documents. They had the wrong letterhead of a government that no longer existed. The foreign minister's name was wrong. There were all kinds of things that the head of the IRA's Iraq Action Team, a French nuclear scientist, just using Google, figured out that it was all wrong within a couple of hours. And yet the U.S. was peddling these things around as if there were proof of something very dramatic. So the brazenness of the bogus claim that was in the State of the Union address, I think, was quite shocking for people. The U.N. went public with it. The U.S. didn't care. There was one U.S. official at the U.S. mission in New York who's actually still quite senior in the Republican world, close to the Trump administration, who actually complained to a colleague of mine at Reuters that it was outrageous that Reuters had a French person covering the U.N. weapons inspection, because everyone knew how biased the French were against the invasion of Iraq. And then my colleague said, you know, Lou's not French. He's from Detroit, Michigan. And, you know, I don't even think he speaks French, which was true. My French is not very good at all, embarrassingly, given my name. Having to speak in German or some other languages at home, but my French is pretty bad. So that was the atmosphere that we were living in. And then you sort of fast forward to now, where bizarre conspiracy theory claims about just about anything are so routine. I mean, back then we were all quite shocked to learn that the U.S. government could just so openly lie about things like that I mean, maybe a case could be made that set the stage for people questioning not just the U.S. government, because governments are always questioned, always should be questioned, but also the mainstream media, because some media did not do proper due diligence when they were reporting, like the aluminum tubes, or others who covered the uranium, because I was covering the UN weapons inspectors and was, you know, on some level partially embedded with them. I was there to hear what they said, and they had a very compelling case. I knew these people and trusted them, so I was reporting on what they said. The people who were writing some of the other things who were using Iraqi defectors or U.S. government officials were confirming what Iraqi defectors had said. They weren't calling the UN and asking for their opinion or assessment of the information that they were getting from the U.S. government. I mean, that's journalism 101, right? But in the rush that you the rush to war, the atmosphere that you described post 9/11, I think that people felt that you could do that. There was a kind of confirmation bias for a lot of people. So I think we're still dealing with it today. I reread the New York Times mea culpa about some of their reporting. I mean, they did some very good reporting, certainly during the Iraq War, but they definitely had some stories that got a lot of traction that, you know, I, for example, was able to knock down very quickly when talking with people to follow up. For example, the aluminum tubes. Yeah, I made a few calls to people who had listened to the presentation of the U.S. team of experts who were sent to Vienna to make the case about these aluminum tubes, and they were, yeah, they said that it was not compelling at all. There were definitely some lapses. I would like to think that we all learned our lessons. I'm not sure about that, and the seeds of doubt were put in everyone's mind. Maybe it would have happened anyway with the explosion of the internet and social media. Those are definitely fertile ground for spreading misinformation. But I do fear that probably the Iraq War played a role in giving that the kind of questioning everything, questioning the mainstream media, giving that legitimacy or more legitimacy than it would otherwise have had.
Right. So you think it did have consequences for the way people went about doing journalism?
Definitely. I mean, you know, I think that, well, journalists, we've had cases of high profile cases of journalists making things up, and so we read about it. Good news organizations will hold those individuals accountable. They will remove the stories. They will issue corrections and apologies and all of that. And these things are always going to happen. You know, everyone makes mistakes. If you make a mistake in an article, you correct it. You issue a formal correction. We all have to do that. Whether we've learned about the bias, I don't know. I feel like sometimes it feels like the media landscape is increasingly polarized. This idea of objectivity and neutrality when reporting, it's really important. I mean, it's difficult to hear. Yeah, we can talk for hours about what is objectivity when you're doing this kind of work, but you know, at the bottom line of it is that if someone tells you something, you ask yourself, why are they telling me this, right? Why is this U.S. government official telling me that this country has tried to, you know, do something that might enable them to develop weapons of mass destruction? So you want to ask yourself why they're telling you this. You will look into, you know, whether the information has any credibility. You try to figure out, are the people I'm looking to for confirmation, are they talking to the people who told me about this originally, and it's really just one source telling me everything? Yeah, you really need to look into these things and question everything. Does everyone do that all of the time? I don't know. it was certainly shocking for the media to see how much airplay some of the allegations got. But the organization I was working for, Reuters, I mean, yeah, they just had me doing my job, and the manner of training that I got about following up and questioning sources, never have more than one source. Always try to get someone on the record if you can. If you can't, discuss with your editors who these unnamed sources are. Try and figure out where they're coming from. Yeah, make a reasonable decision. Get the lawyers involved if necessary. That was how we did it, and you know, it was fine from my perspective. I mean, I feel pretty proud of the work I did at the time prior to the Iraq War. It has withstood the test of time, and I guess that there are other reporters out there who don't feel as good about what they did in the run-up to the U.S. invasion.
Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, I mean, how do you think this has affected, you know, the sort of practices of lying in government? I mean, it's always true that politicians lie about certain things. I mean, it just kind of goes without saying, but you know, we have seen in recent years a president who's prepared to take that level of lying, it seems, by the Washington Post's count, you know, to a whole new level. And I guess I wonder, you know, to what extent did the path to Trump, begin in the justifications of the Iraq War by the U.S. government?
Well, certainly the idea that the U.S. government lied, but we can't take them seriously, with things that President Trump said, like, do you think we're a bunch of angels, or however he said it when he was asked why he was defending Vladimir Putin. And, yeah, he basically took the position that, you know, the U.S. government has a lot of skeletons in its closet. It's done a lot of bad things, which of course is true. Like, we all know that. But this idea that somehow, you know, everything is in doubt and you just dismiss everything. I mean, giving sort of legitimacy to conspiracy theories. Certainly, I think it got a few legs up thanks to Donald Trump. There were a lot of things that were said during that time. Yeah, if we think about COVID and the kind of strange things that came out of the White House at that time, that people should use bleach. And at the same time, we're still discussing things like, when we talk about COVID, the origin of the pandemic, and after initially being dismissed because President Trump was promoting it, but the lab leak theory has kind of gotten a new lease on life, and people are taking it more seriously than they did before. I mean, I am not a scientist in that world, so I can't speak with any authority about it. I know what I read, and I do know that it's no longer being dismissed on both sides of the aisle in Congress. So what's a conspiracy theory today, could get some traction later on. But, point is that, liars, I guess I haven't done an empirical study of it, but it does seem like there's more of them. And I'll give another example, not President Trump, who is famous for throwing out all the lies. One of the things when we talk about the Iraq War, and now that we have the 20th anniversary, in my entire reporting career covering the United Nations, and particularly over the last sort of 12 years, I would say, the Russians have been very, very keen on bringing up the lies in Iraq. Anytime the U.S. made an allegation about Russia or China or some other country, they'd say, why should we believe you? Remember what you said about Iraq. The Russians still do that to this day. The Russian ambassador at the United Nations, if there's a meeting of the UN Security Council on Ukraine and Russia's invasion of Ukraine based on the flimsy list of pretexts that they were supposedly going to go and quote-unquote denazify Ukraine, one of the things that they say when they get criticized is, how dare you in the United States criticize us? You look what you did in Iraq. You say that we invaded sovereign territory. Well, that's what you did in 2003 with Iraq. I mean, lied about the weapons of mass destruction. Of course, there's a huge problem there, right? But the U.S., we know the U.S. invaded Iraq on the basis of a false pretext and lies about weapons of mass destruction. That doesn't make it right for Russia on February 24th, 2022, to also then, lie about supposed Nazis running wild in Ukraine, and then to go and invade and supposedly serve the country and subject them to relentless bombing raids, bombing attacks against civilians, and things that the United States and Britain did in Iraq. The United States and Britain used thousands of cluster munitions. Russia has done that in Ukraine too. But I don't want to talk like they're equivalent, but certainly the United States continues to have to defend the indefensible regarding what it did in 2003 in Iraq. And it's a stain on the sort of U.S. legacy that I don't think they're ever going to get rid of. The Russians are always going to question everything the U.S. says, every allegation, and say, remember Iraq. And,
Two wrongs don't make a right, but the first one opens the door to U2 when they commit the second one.
Exactly. That's where we're at, and I guess we'll always be there.
Yeah. Well, this was a terrific conversation and sort of review of the period since the Iraq War started in 2003 and the run-up to it in 2002. But that's it for today's episode. I want to thank Louis Charbonneau of Human Rights Watch and the CUNY Graduate Center for sharing his insights on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. Remember to subscribe and rate International Horizons on SoundCloud, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. I want to thank Osvaldo Mena Aguilar for his technical assistance, and to thank Duncan McKay for sharing this song International Horizons as the theme music for the show. This is John Torpy saying thanks for joining us, and we look forward to having you with us for the next episode of International Horizons.